Welcome to the Infantry Podcast. This is Brian, and today we are in the midst of the Maneuver Warfighter Conference here at Fort Moore, Georgia. And I was fortunate enough to get linked up with a gentleman that I remember several years ago sharing on Twitter before it was when it was Twitter, not X, an excerpt from this speech because I thought that it was the coolest thing that I had ever heard. And I used it to like motivate my players, and they were like, Coach, I'm not really going with that. But everybody knows that speech. And the gentleman that gave that speech is sitting across from me today. He's not an 11 series, but that's okay because he was the third senior enlisted advisor to the Joint Chief.
To the chairman of the Joint
Chief. Chairman of the Joint Chief. See, yeah. I screwed it up always. So joining me today is John Wayne Troxell.
Brian, it's an honor to be here with you. Thanks so much for having me. It's just I'm elated to be here.
Well, we caught a lot of grief for bringing you up here because, so what MOS were you going in?
Or? I was a 19 Delta. I was an Armored Reconnaissance Specialist, but I spent so much time in the 82nd Airborne Division and in striker units and things that people, and then I did all the things infantrymen are expected to do. I'm a ranger, I'm a jump master, I'm a pathfinder, you know, and I'm an order St. Michael guy too, and everybody thought I was an infantryman. You know, I was a command sergeant major of a striker brigade combat team, an infantry brigade, you know. People have thought that because of all the things that I've done, and then I've always been a proponent for getting after the enemy in their security and support zones, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan, which means that you had to get off of your vehicles and you had to get inserted by helicopters or you had to go on foot and everything. And it was, I had this infantry kind of focus throughout my career that people thought I was an infantryman, but I am an armor guy, and I was the last U.S. Army Armor Center Command Sergeant Major at Fort Knox. prior to it moving down here, the armor school moving down here. So I'm in fact an armor guy, but I spent a lot more of my time on the infantry side, you know, and as a brigade CSM running EIB as an armor brigade or as an armor CSM, obviously my infantry battalion CSMs helped a lot and everything. So I've got some infantry in my heart and I've definitely got some infantry in my boots, you know.
Yeah. So for all you haters, just you go kick rocks. All right. I mean, yeah, this guy is infantry through and through.
But just, you know, I think if you live the warrior ethos every day of your life, how you get up in the morning, how you challenge yourself physically, how you challenge yourself mentally, emotionally, technically, and tactically to be the best warrior and best leader that you can be, your MOS is irrelevant, you know?
Amen.
That's just what you do, you know? But if you live this warrior ethos and you understand the battlefield, the complexities of it, the 3D battlefield, and at the tactical, operational, strategic level, it doesn't matter what your military occupational specialty is, you are going to be seen as a modern-day warrior.
Awesome. So with that, let's get into John Wayne Troxell.
Yeah.
So where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Springfield, Illinois, and shortly after I was born, my family, we moved to Davenport, Iowa, Quad Cities, USA. And I grew up there in Davenport, blue-collar town, you know, and, you know, I, in my hometown there and in my neighborhood, the West End, we called it, which was a very low-end neighborhood, you know, with a lot of crime and stuff like that, and not a lot of good things going on, but that's kind of where I cut my teeth in terms of the warrior ethos, you know, by as I grew. So did I grew in learning, you know, in school and everything, but I also learned the art of being able to fight and stuff like that. And in my formative years in high school, I did a lot more fighting than I did studying. And so I barely graduated high school, but I would see guys from my neighborhood who had left to go into military service, you know, whether it was the Army or the Marine Corps. And when they came back, I saw this transformation where they were just like me when they left, but when they came back, they were a lot more confident. They were sinewy, muscular from, you know, being hardened into these warriors and everything. They walked with their head held high, and they were boisterous and confident and everything. And I thought, I don't know what kind of drug they fed them, but I want some of that. So, yeah, that's where I grew up at, and that's how I got attracted to military service.
So you ended up enlisting.
Yeah.
What year?
1982, May 4, 1982, I enlisted. I left for basic training on the 1st of September, 82.
Wow. I won't tell you how old I was. So Josh and I, actually, our birthdays are 2 days apart.
Oh, really?
On the same year.
Yeah.
1981.
Oh, okay. So you guys were, you know, in diapers when I joined the military.
I think I was still at Fort Riley with my dad.
Oh, okay.
So my dad was doing some general staff work in the 1st ID.
Yeah.
And, yeah, because I was born there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. All right. So 1982, all right. You go and join up. Why 19 series?
So when I went into the recruiter office, so every one of the guys that I knew that grew up, that were my friends, that were older than me, that joined the Army, came back as infantrymen. And so I wanted to do that, but I wanted to do something. And so the guy that was my recruiter was a 19 Delta. And he started showing me this picture of, you know, guys on motorcycles doing reconnaissance and on the sides of mountains doing reconnaissance and everything. And that kind of attracted me a little bit more. And so I thought, and I was lacking a little self-confidence. And so my friends that came back as these hardened infantrymen, I wasn't convinced that I could do that, you know. So I said, okay, this doesn't look as hard as being an infantryman, so let me go and try this, you know. And then when I realized when I was in basic training that, you know, I was like Forrest Gump. I fit into the military like one of those round pegs. And I ended up being an honor graduate at my basic training, you know, and everything, and my OSA training. So that's why I started going there. but as I grew in the military, I was more attracted to being with light infantry. Mm. And that's what I wanted to be around. But I wasn't going to change my MOS or who I was, because I had made a commitment that this is what I was going to do, and I was going to do it. And how could I best support infantrymen as a 19 Delta? And so my best times in my career were when I was with light units, like the 82nd Airborne Division for 14 years and everything. You know, heavy mech units, no disrespect, but I wasn't really the mounted warfare kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to be able to have the leverage to get on the ground and build competitive advantages against the enemy.
So you finish OSIT, basic training, all those things. What's your first unit?
3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, Fort Bliss, Texas.
Okay. What platform were you on?
Well, actually, when I got there, there was M1 tanks. The M1 had just come out. And they were M113 armored personnel carriers. Mm-hmm. This was pre-Bradley fighting vehicle.
Correct.
But when I got there...
This is a baited question, by the way.
Yeah, oh, I know. But I didn't get assigned to a line unit. I got assigned to the 1st Squadron headquarters in the S3 shop as a brand-new private. So I wasn't doing my duties as a cavalry scout. Mm-hmm. I was a driver for the operations officer, and I was doing menial stuff, you know, and setting up the tactical operations center and stuff like that in the field. And so this is where I started to get a little, disenfranchised and with the military and a little disheartened, you know, that this is what I said, I'm supposed to be out sneaking and peeking and finding the enemy and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm putting up camouflage nets, you know? Mm-hmm. So, from there, what really caught my eye to move on and stay in the military. One, I got there in January of 83. In February of 83, I met a young lady named Sandra Jimenez. And 6 months later, she and I got married. And last week, we celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary.
Hey, congratulations.
So, yeah. So initially, now I have a family. And, oh, by the way, right after we got married, we were expecting our first son. So I knew I had family responsibilities. But I was also coming off out of the motor pool there at Fort Bliss, coming back to my headquarters, and I saw this big strapping guy standing outside at Parade Rest with a maroon beret on. And I'm like, who is this guy? What is this guy doing? And I walked up to him, and he was a young sergeant, and I was only a private. And I was like, I'm not going to say anything to this guy, you know. And one of our officers had come out, a young lieutenant, and said to him, hey, Sergeant, you can come on in here if you'd like and wait for your boss to come out. And he looked at this lieutenant. He said, with all due respect, Lieutenant, I don't hang around legs. He was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division.
Yep.
And here I was, as young private, just looking in awe at this guy.
Yep.
And when I looked at him, he had this rifle above his chest. So he had an expert infantryman's badge on. He had a Ranger tab above his airborne tab and everything. And he was just this hulking looking guy. And then I walked in, and there was a lieutenant in there from the 82nd that was, what we were doing is they were coordinating range stuff, and they were going to do a jump out at McGregor Range here and everything. And so after they left, I was like, hey, those guys, they look pretty tough. And I had this staff sergeant that was in charge of me. He was a tanker, and, you know, he was overweight. Mm-hmm. He had his big old strappy boots on, and he immediately starts criticizing them. Oh, those eight airborne guys think they're this and that, you know, and they don't like us non-airborne types and stuff like that. So, Troxel, they're never going to like you and everything. So, anyways, you know, the jump is going on the next day, and our ops officer, Major Dan Ruiz, says, who wants to volunteer to go out and pull detail out there? I raise my hand right away.
Yeah.
I want to go out and check these guys out.
I want to see this.
Yeah. And so when I went out there and I observed the jump, and then I saw the movements, you know, them getting after their assault objectives and everything afterwards, I was like, man, that is cool. And
so
that's what I want to do.
Yeah. So I have a question on that. The reason I asked about the platform,
mm-hmm.
my dad was a Sheridan guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So were the 82nd jumping Sheridans at that time, or they'd already kicked them out?
No. They had them. As a matter of fact, when I went to the 82nd in 1987, I was on Sheridans for 5 years, 87 to 92. And then when I came back, 95 to 96, as a matter of fact, I did the jump in Operation Just Cause in 89, the combat mm-hmm. jump, where we heavy dropped our Sheridans in, and I fought on a Sheridan there.
Wow.
And I fought on a Sheridan in Desert Storm.
I thought they were already out by that point.
Oh, no.
So
we, as a matter of fact, I was a first sergeant in that battalion, 373 Armor, in 1996 when we deactivated the battalion and the Sheridans went away.
Yeah, so with my mom being sick and then my dad having some health issues too. So when I would go visit, like, especially now coming on board as an Army civilian, like, he is starting to open up a lot more. My uncle was an Apache pilot. He's opening up a lot more. And so Dad and I started talking about the Sheridan and the Flechette round.
Yeah.
Because he was like 78 to like 83, 84.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about if the Flechette round had – continued to be around and be used in like Iraq and like hitting some of those mud huts with, you know, a flechette round, what it would look
with
like
10,000 little arrows coming out.
Yeah, like, ooh, talk about some building clearing, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's why I said it was a baited question.
Yeah.
All right, so 82nd, you watch them jump, you go out. What, I mean, do you just like go, hey, can I go back with y'all? Or
well, I you know, after that I came back, and a friend of mine who had entered the Army about the same time, was a 19 Delta II. His name was Randy Bragg. He and I both said, hey, we want to go to airborne school, you know, and we were getting pushback. And then we both came down on orders for Germany. And that meant we were going to go to, you know, heavy mech units, another heavy mech unit, you know, and at that point in time, the border was still up between East Germany and mm-hmm. West Germany and everything. So he and I applied for airborne school, and we were accepted. So we went to airborne school together, and we thought we would graduate airborne school and get assigned to the 82nd. Well, we graduated airborne school, and they kept us on orders for Germany. So we graduated in 84, and, you know, we're disappointed that we were going to heavy mech units again. And, again, I have nothing against heavy mech units.
Right.
It's just that I wanted to be a paratrooper.
Yeah, it's personal choice.
Yeah. And so in, you know, in 84, after graduation, I found myself in Germany in the 3rd Armored Division doing heavy mech stuff again.
Wow. All right. So Germany, heavy mech.
Yeah.
I mean, have you
on a, are you on a platform at this point?
Or? Yeah, I was on, at that point in time, I was in a scout platoon that had 3 113 armored personnel carriers and 3 M901 improved tow vehicle platforms. So the six vehicle configuration was meant that the battalion commander of the tank battalion had 3 reconnaissance vehicles that could go out and, you know, identify and defeat the enemy reconnaissance and give the commander the read of the battle. And they had their own overwatch, long distance overwatch, in terms of these improved tow vehicles. So you could set up one of these ITVs and the APC could go on and do their reconnaissance mission. And if they encountered heavy, like tanks or enemy tanks or anything like that, they had a tank defeating capability with their wingman, which had a tow platform on it.
Interesting.
And so that I spent a lot of time on the improved tow vehicle while I was there. And, you know, again, being a heavy guy, the things that I wanted to do, hard PT, you know, obstacle course kind of stuff, jumping out of airplanes, being gritty and hard, it just, the mindset wasn't the same. It was like, hey, look, you know, you had death before dismount, okay? It's basically yeah. kind of the way we were.
And you got your appetite wet, you know, doing your jumps here for airborne school.
Yes, I did. When I graduated airborne school in February of 84 right here at Fort Moore, I went and bought the airborne T-shirts, you know. I had, you know, everything. You know, I was in, you know. And here I am in Germany running around with airborne T-shirts on, you know, and everything. And people are like, well, we don't do that stuff here, you know. I mean, so it was a little disheartening, you know. But at that point in time, I was bought into the military, you know, for the most part, because I had a wife, I had a brand new baby, my oldest son. And I just said, hey, I'm going to make the best of what I can in the situation I am. But when it came time to reenlist, I said, I'm either going to the 82nd Airborne Division or we're getting out of the military, to my wife. She wanted to go back to El Paso, you know, Fort Bliss, where mm-hmm. she was from. But she understood the passion that I had mm-hmm. for wanting to be in an elite unit. And so when I reenlisted, I ended up in the 82nd and the 3rd Battalion, 73rd Armor, the free world's only airborne armor battalion. And that's where my career took off from there. Because when you look at that battalion, and I was having a conversation with a general officer and a command sergeant major yesterday here, and we were talking about that little battalion produced more strategic and operational leaders, especially in the enlisted ranks. Think of this. I was SEAC number 3. SEAC number 1 was Command Sergeant Major Joe Ganey, mm-hmm. whom the Ganey Cup is named after.
Correct.
There's been 4 SEACs in the history of the position, senior enlisted advisor to the chairman. 2 of them have been Army guys, and both of them have come out of the 3rd Battalion, 73rd Armor, 82nd Airborne Division. That shows you not only the caliber of talent we had in that battalion, but the level of leaders that mentored us, like Command Sergeant Major Ron Reagan, who's in the 82nd Airborne Division Hall of Fame, and folks like that. And when you look at not just 2 SEACs, but 3 and 4-star level Command Sergeant Majors that came out of that battalion, it was a huge talent pool of armor enlisted that were supporting infantry operations in the 82nd and then further on in our career. So
what do you think the secret sauce is there? But I mean, besides like, you know, I mean, talented people in a culture, right? Organizational culture.
Yeah.
What do you think is
it? So a strict adherence to discipline and standards, striving for excellence in every task. And what Ron Reagan taught us was, I don't care if it's shooting gunnery or if it's taking a PT test or if it's cleaning a latrine, you will strive for excellence in everything you do. And it was a type A personality organization. Mm. If someone came in, I mean, we were a battalion full of piranha. And if somebody came in acting like a goldfish, they were going to get eaten.
They didn't last long.
Yeah, they didn't last long. Because you couldn't come in and say, I'm just going to shoot for minimum standards. If you did that, you would be identified in a hurry. And you wouldn't be ostracized, you know, publicly. But over the course in time, there wouldn't be trust put into you that you could do the things necessary, you know, to get the job done without being micromanaged. And so nobody would empower you. And pretty soon you became irrelevant. And soon after that, they would leave the organization.
And so that's an interesting point, because I love how Sebastian Younger puts it,
yeah,
talking about tribe,
mm-hmm,
right? You want to know what an elite organization, you want to know that an elite organization is elite, it manages itself.
Exactly.
Right? It self-regulates. You know, the leaders don't have to do it, because the individuals who are a part of it are involved. And you know, tribes, whether it be, you know, Native American, Indigenous, anywhere, you know, it does take a village. And
yeah,
and that's why those you know, those, they were successful. They were raising, you know, everybody was invested in it. And when you look at high-performing organizations, that's what happens.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And we talked constantly about going to war. It was, everything we did was based around fighting and winning. And we were a peacetime military in the 80s. You know?
And it wasn't if, it was when.
It was when, yeah. When we get the call, we have to be ready to fight and win on a moment's notice. And the other thing about this tribe that you just talked about, Brian, I had a fellow squad leader that, you know, was in a different company than me. And one day he had a family emergency come up, and he was a primary jump master on a jump that evening, you know, on a night mass tactical jump. And he had to go and take care of this family thing. I was in a different company. He came over to me and said, hey, can you cover me as the primary jump master tonight, because I've got this thing going on with my spouse? I said, brother, I got you. Just give me the details and I'll get it. And boom, I went and did his duties for him, okay? And then a couple years later, you know, my wife went into labor with our second son, and I was expected to be the primary jump master on a jump that night. So instead of me going to my leaders and saying, hey, I can't do this and everything, I went to another company and saw another one of these alpha male piranha guys and said, hey, brother, can you cover me tonight? And who is not going to turn down the opportunity to be the primary jump master on a high-performance aircraft putting 100 paratroopers out over a drop zone at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Mm.
That was the kind of organization we had, that it was self-correcting, and we didn't have to push issues up to the leaders. We, as peers, could help each other out, even though we might be in different companies and doing different things at the time. That was the level of trust, the level of camaraderie. It, that's what, you know, when Sebastian Younger talks about tribe, that's what it was all about, and that's why that organization was so successful.
Trust.
Trust.
You hit, I was waiting on you to hit that word,
yeah,
because that is the key, right?
Yeah.
He trusts you to run his company, his jump,
yeah,
a very dangerous, you know, event.
Yeah.
Right? But you also had the trust in him that his people were trained, ready, knew what to do. And so it was no factor for you to step in and do it. It wasn't going to put you, you know, in any kind of situation, because
yeah,
you knew the standard that they were at, and you trusted it.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's phenomenal.
And this is what I say about that organization. So when I got selected by Marine General Joe Dunford to serve as the senior enlisted guy in the Department of Defense, senior enlisted advisor to the chairman, I got interviewed shortly after that by all of the military, you know, the Military Times folks and folks like that. And they asked me a question: how do you attribute your success in being able to get to this level and then ultimately being selected? I said, it started with my experience in the 3rd Battalion, 73rd Armor, 82nd Airborne Division. And I said, I was just one of many. There could have been 50 SEACs that came out of that battalion. That's how talented we were and how close we were in propping each other up,
mm-hmm,
and making, you know, all of us, you know, as best as we could be, and how we set conditions in the organization to strive for excellence.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so you're there. What happens next? Anything that sticks out? Any leaders? So this is also something. Anyone that specifically, like, pours into you? You mentioned, you know, Sergeant Major Reagan.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Well, so here it is, December of 1989. I'm on Division Ready Force 1, is what we called it back then, and which meant that we were on a one-hour recall, and it was during half-day schedule during the Christmas holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 19th of December, I didn't, because I was on one-hour recall, I wasn't on leave. We didn't have block leave back then like they do now. But I couldn't go on leave anyways because I was on one-hour recall. But we were on half-day schedule. So I kissed my wife goodbye the morning of the 19th of December and said, hey, I'll see you at noon, and we can go Christmas shopping for the boys. Well, I drive into Fort Bragg at the time, and it was an open post back then. Mm-hmm. But there's MPs guarding, you know, the open entrances and everything. And I pull up to the MP and I said, hey, what's going on, brother? Showing him my ID. And he says, I don't know. We're just doing 100% ID check here. I said, well, this is weird. Starting on the half day schedule. When I got to my unit, realized that the Division Ready Force One had been alerted. And we thought, again, we're a peacetime military. We thought, are these assholes going to make us do a freaking training jump here on half-day schedule? I mean, what kind of shit is this, you know? Yeah, yeah. Excuse my language, you know.
It's the infantry podcast.
Yeah, really. That's right, yeah. But so we get taken over to the pre-deployment area, the personnel holding area, the PHA, we called it back then, and it was tents on Pope Airfield, and it was freezing rain out. I mean, it was cold as shit. We had little heaters, you know, but... But my platoon sergeant at the time was a guy named Sergeant First Class Dave Freeman. And I was a staff sergeant, you know, a Sheridan commander there. And we just got sick of, hey, what's this all about and everything. So he and I walked over to the brigade headquarters, the brigade talk. And here we are, a platoon sergeant and a squad leader walking in, up to the brigade talk. And there's a guard out there. And we come walking up, you know, and the guard says, hey, can I see you? And we just walked right by the guy. And we walked right into the brigade talk. And when we walked in, right there on the map board, there were staff officers that were laminating maps of Panama. And we looked at each other and we said, well, we know what we're doing now. And then while we were standing there before we got thrown out, I heard the S3 Air officer, the guy that's responsible for jumps, the combat jump will be at 500 feet, so we need to make a decision whether we jump with reserve parachutes or not. And I was like, well, I know what we're doing now, so... We went back. So Freeman was a guy that, you know, I was a high-energy staff sergeant. You know, I was an aggressive kind of guy.
Not you.
Yeah, you know. And, you know, and a guy that was constantly, you know, moving with a sense of purpose and you know, and everything. And so Freeman was the right guy to be my platoon sergeant because he was a calm, kind of sage kind of leader and everything. And we go back and we tell all the troops in the tent now, hey, we're going to war. And not only are we going to war, we're doing a combat jump in Panama City. And so the chaplain walks in, you know, and says, hey, does anybody here want to do a prayer before the mission? And everybody. You know, they say the old thing, no atheists in foxholes.
Correct.
There was not one paratrooper that was not going to join this chaplain in a prayer. But Dave Freeman was a guy. And then throughout our 3 weeks in Panama, he was just a leader. And then... You know, as we started redeploying forces after we had already kicked the shit out of the Panamanian Defense Forces and Noriega's Dignity Battalions and all of them, and order started getting restored in Panama City, we started rotating forces back. Well, Freeman comes to me, you know, and says, well, hey, I'm the last guy leaving, and you're the second to the last guy, so don't pack your shit, brother. You're staying here with me, all right? But the bottom line was Freeman was a great leader, and then he was my platoon sergeant in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, too. Because we came back from Panama 6 months later, we are deploying again after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and everything. And here we are. We sat for 8 months out in the desert, you know, as that line in the sand. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you know, as part of the greater coalition force, we entered into Iraq, into Kuwait, and you know, ousted Saddam's ass out of there and everything. So Freeman was my platoon sergeant in both of those deployments and a guy that I really looked up to and had a lot of impact on my development.
So in Desert Storm, were you guys – so 18 Airborne Corps was on the left side.
Far left flank.
Correct.
The only people on the further left than us was the French 6th Light Armored Division.
Okay.
So that shows you – you know, and – I don't know where you were going with that question, but our level of combat in Desert Storm was nowhere near what the heavy forces were in Kuwait and right outside Kuwait and everything.
Yeah, a personal connection. My uncle was had gotten attached to 18 Airborne Corps
yeah.
as an Apache, so like he was doing the operations.
You know, he probably saw a lot of good combat. He probably killed a lot of armored vehicles and everything.
Maybe. I'm still trying to get him to talk about that. So I want him to come on the infantry podcast because he was infantry, because aviation wasn't a branch.
Yeah.
No, we've talked a little bit about it. I think he was more in the talk, like planning, you know, the highway of death and those things, you know, shoot the front one, shoot the back one, then
in
the middle.
Yeah.
But no, that's, I like making connections, right, with those things. All right, and we talked about this earlier, and you're on a Sheridan. Everybody thinks it's all, you know, McMaster and the Bradleys at 73 Easting.
Yeah.
And you know, the Abrams tanks, but there were, my dad's going to be happy, there were Sheridans there.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So let me back up to Just Cause.
Okay.
So, the Rangers, you know, who had, you know, the 1st and 2nd Battalion of the Rangers had jumped in. 3rd Battalion wasn't activated yet. And 1st Battalion was working with in the Panama City area and the outlying areas, getting after high-value targets in the Panamanian Defense Forces, but more importantly, Noriega's Dignity Battalions, who were really the ones that were the holdouts, you know, Noriega's kind of bodyguard military and everything. And so they needed armor support. And so my platoon was attached to 1st Ranger Battalion. And we did this mission rolling down the road of Highway 1 in Panama City. And here's my Sheridan. And I've got Ranger motorcycles up front, Ranger motorcycles in the rear, Ranger gun jeeps on either side of me. And I have a squad of Rangers on top of my Sheridan. And we're you talking about some badassery rolling down the road and looking for a fight, you know? Yeah. I mean, that was the ultimate, you know?
Mr. James Dietz, can we get a print made of this so we can get the SEAC 3 to sign it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Of just badassery going down the road. Yeah, like Rangers on motorcycles.
Yeah.
Yep, never heard that one, right?
No.
And I think you're the third person from Just Cause. So Mike Kelso.
Yeah.
Jeff Mellinger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were both there. Interviewed both of them.
Yeah.
Great Americans.
Both of them good friends of mine.
Yeah. And now we're getting a different perspective.
Yeah.
Right? And so, all right, you're rolling in, Rangers, you got the Sheridan. All right, what happens?
Well, they put me in an overwatch position where I could provide supporting fires, and they proceeded in to get after the targets they had to get after. So there was some close combat with them and everything. At one point, I got called forward because they had identified a Panamanian vehicle, an F-300 armored vehicle. It was French-made, but the Panamanian military.
Yeah, and they not Ford F-350.
Yeah, and they wanted me to come in and take it out and everything. But by the time I got up into position, the crew had already surrendered and everything. So I provided supporting fires with 50 cal and 7.62 and everything. I wanted to fire a flechette round, you know, but that opportunity never arose. And as you know, with that cone direction that it goes in trajectory, there's opportunity for civilian casualties too. So I never got the opportunity to fire that. But that's kind of what I did with them. And, you know, supporting the 82nd during the initial assault, you know, I was basically the only cover these infantrymen would have. You know, we rolled down the bar, one of the barrios, and we're moving down the road, and a 14.5 gun opens up on us, and I want to pull up and eliminate the target, and I've got paratroopers hugging my road wheels and everything. And I talk about this in my memoir, my book, and I said, hey, move the fuck out, all right, before I squash your asses, all right? And let me get up here and get after this vehicle. And so I got up there and put suppressing fire on this vehicle, and they eventually surrendered too. But I wanted to have the first armored combat kill since Vietnam. But the minute we pulled up there, these guys, Panamanians, white flags everywhere, they were surrendering everything. So they were okay getting into a fight, you know, with 50 cal and below. But the men had seen the vehicle come up with a 152-millimeter main gun. They were like, you done got the last click out of Junior.
Well, and so for those people that don't know, the Sheridan, correct me if I'm wrong, was designed really for the jungles of Vietnam.
Yes.
And the flechette round was created to penetrate through, you know, that underbrush, that just jungleness, right?
Absolutely.
To get in there where, you know, you can't see.
Yeah.
And to just, you know, be able to clear areas. So,
yeah.
Because now, you know, everybody thinks, you know, Brad's and, you know, Strikers and MRAPs and Abrams tanks. So, really just kind of wanted to hit that point because a lot of people don't even know what the Sheridan
is.
Well,
and then the Viet Cong, as an insurgent force, used that canopy jungle as protection. So, it also added value in terms of, you know, because these were insurgent forces, and it happened with the North Vietnamese army as well, when they would try to hide in that canopy and everything, and they've already exposed themselves as a threat by shooting at the American troops, they would just fire that flechette round and turn, you know, not only eliminate the canopy, but turn the Viet Cong into pin cushions,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, so, I mean, it was a very lethal weapon at very close ranges, you know?
All right, so we jumped backwards. We went to Panama.
Yeah.
We talked about that. Let's jump forward, all right?
Yep.
Desert Shield, Desert Storm, all right?
Yeah.
Left hook.
Left hook, you know, we moved out, and, you know, we had a few events there. Obviously, for me, Desert Shield, you know, with the Scud missiles that Hussein would periodically fire into Saudi Arabia, you know, we spent a lot of time in mission-oriented protective posture 4 in our chem gear, which absolutely sucked and everything. But that was probably the worst of the combat. The minute we crossed the border, we had such overwhelming superior firepower within the U.S. and coalition forces that we would roll up on targets where we would get intelligence that said, all right, Iraqi armored platoon here, and we'd roll up, and there would already be hundreds of coalition vehicles that have already come across that area and have eliminated that threat. And I knew when we came across, because of where we were at, and we were not down, we were a supporting effort, and we were not part of the main effort, that our combat was going to be limited. And it was very limited there, even though there were some engagements, you know, that others got into and everything. But I will tell you, Brian, I think it was out of the 100-hour war, I think we were on like hour 40, and I was sitting in an overwatch position supporting 1st Brigade of the 82nd, you know, all these infantrymen on the ground, and a convoy was coming up to pass us, and I, on the back of one of these tractor trailers was a bunch of freaking porta potties. And, brother, when the shitters pass you up on the battlefield, you know your hard combat is done. And I looked at my crew and I said, boys, the rest of this mission is going to be follow and support.
Yeah.
And unless there are some rogue Iraqi tank or Iraqi platoon, I don't know how there could have been a rogue one because we had so much superior firepower on the ground, in the air, and everything. And we had eyes forward and everywhere. There was no way that Iraqi military could get any advantages over us.
So I've talked to a couple of people that were in that fight, and they were Bradleys and things. So GPS was just coming out at this point. What was your experience with, lack of a better, land nav in your vehicle? Like, I've heard stories about, like, 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper that were the entire, like, map, and they were having to, like, put it up on the back hatch and
yeah,
tape
that's
it
what
up
it was. So we had a stack of maps, and we would drive till we got off of that map. But again, we were doing basically terrain association, which is tough in the desert, but because we didn't have GPS at that time, you know. And again, we were following in support, being tanks supporting infantry. We were following our infantry. You know, the guys would get on the vehicle. They rode in trucks. They were, you know, motorized infantry. And we would just follow them. And until we did that hook, you know, which basically ended the conflict after 100 hours, we were basically following folks in front of us that we were supporting, you know. But the key thing, a lot of people forget, the key to the success of Operation Desert Storm was the air war. And the decimation that our Air Force, our Navy fighter jets, our Marine fighter jets, and our Army Apaches and everything that your uncle was on and all that stuff, the level of destruction we put on the Iraqi military through that air war made it so much easier on the ground effort. When you're talking 430,000 Iraqi troops in Kuwait and southern Iraq at the time, I mean, that's, and here we were, a force of about 300,000.
Right.
But we had coalition forces with us. We were able to see first. We were able to understand first, which allowed us to act first. And ultimately, we finished decisively in everything we did.
It sounds a lot like a lot of Sun Tzu.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it was. And so Desert Storm wasn't as sexy as Just Cause, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of enemy fire and contact and everything. But it was still, you know, it was awesome to be a part of this coalition that ousted a ruthless dictator. And then we decimated the Iraqi military, who was the fourth largest army in the world. And when we got done with them, they were the ninth largest army in the world. So that shows you the level of destruction,
yeah.
you know, that we put on them. And being a part of that large operation and you know, ground combat was just, it was something proud for us, especially after just 6 months earlier doing this combat jump into Panama.
Wow. I don't know. I guess I never thought about that. So you're at, what, 8, 9 years in at this point?
Yeah, 9 years in. As a matter of fact, when we were in the desert, I was selected for Sergeant First Class. I got the word. And when I returned from Desert Storm, I went to my advanced non-commissioned officer course at Fort Knox. And while I was there, I was promoted to Sergeant First Class. And then soon after, I went back to Germany with the 3rd Infantry Division, the 3rd Squadron, 4th Cavalry.
All right. So Germany, like now we're into
92 to 95 time frame.
When did the wall come down?
The wall came down in 89.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was like, yeah. I had to do the math. Yeah. Right. So what's it like in Germany at this point? Like, I mean,
so it's interesting here. I get over there. I'm a 2-time combat veteran now. And I understand what readiness means. I understand what lethality means. I understand what it means to be ready to fight and win. And when I got over there, the first thing we started hearing about was Yugoslavia mm-hmm. and the infighting that was going on in Sarajevo and the human rights violations that were going on. And my commander at the time of my squadron was a guy named James D. Thurman, who retired as a 4-star general, very influential in the Army community. He served as the U.S. Forces Command commander. He served as U.S. Forces Korea commander, very influential guy. And as a lieutenant colonel, he was a battalion operations officer during Desert Storm with the 1st Cavalry Division, so he was in the main effort of the fight. Mm-hmm. And so when he came in there, I had this attitude of, we got to be prepared to fight and win now. And he came in, and he had that vision as a commander, and that worked right in. But everybody else around me had this peacetime military, you know. In our squadron, it was, you know, I mean, you wore spit shine boots to the field and everything. And I'm like, what saved me was my first sergeant was a guy named John Winters, who was with me in the 82nd. And I had good platoon leaders that, but I mean, I made my guys wear camouflage paint in the field, even though we were on Bradley fighting vehicles and M1 tanks. I made them wear body armor in the field. I said, we are going to train like we fight. And we did PT every day, you know, to a hard standard. We did marksmanship, you know, to a hard standard, even though the tanks and Bradleys were the killing machines. We did first aid right. We learned the languages of, you know, the former wow. Yugoslavia,
yeah.
you know, Staniti ili putsam, you know,
idea.
You know, means stop or I'm going to kill you, you know,
oh, wow. yeah.
you know,
that's an important phrase.
Yeah, it is. But we did everything like that. And more importantly, when we were off duty, we did things together as a platoon. And so I was a platoon sergeant, a B troop, 3/4 cav for my entire 3 years there. And I realized soon after I got there that in Vietnam, there was a lieutenant named Steindam, who was a platoon leader of 3rd Platoon, B Troop, 3/4 cav in Vietnam, and he was awarded the Medal of Honor. And so I built an obstacle course there on Schweinfurt base, and I named it Steindam Obstacle Course. And we did it all out of our own pockets with mm-hmm. stuff that we found and everything, and that became our platoon obstacle course. And that was kind of the things that we were doing. We were getting after honoring our legacy. We were getting after ready to fight and win. But more importantly, off duty, we did so much together as a platoon with our families and everything. And we were cohesive as heck, you know. And we never had to go to war, 92 to 95, you know, but we were ready at any moment's notice. And I would have other people, why are you guys being so hardcore? What's with this camouflage and body armor? I said, I know this. You know, there was a guy killed in Panama that was on an armored vehicle, because and he didn't have any face paint on. He took his helmet off, and a Panamanian sniper shot him right in the face and killed him. You know, it was a lieutenant. And I said, so that's not going to happen to us. So we're going to do the things that we're expected to do in the field, and we are going to strive for excellence in everything we do. And there ain't going to be none of this minimal standard bullshit, all right? We are going to be the best that we can be. And in the end, we won top platoon, you know, on gunnery. Soldier of the month, soldier of the year competitions, we would win. You know, we did so much things to get after it. And that was probably one of the most fruitful assignments, because I had such great non-commissioned officers below me, guys that went on to be sergeant majors, guys like Steve Zebarth and Vince Cunningham and these other guys that understood and got after it, you know, and we did everything collectively. And it was a tribe again, you know. It was this tribe.
So as a platoon sergeant, I want to take a little time because I think this is important. Is this the first time you were charged with kind of your own lieutenant?
No, I was actually a platoon sergeant as a staff sergeant in the 82nd.
Yeah. So you had some experience.
Yeah, I had some experience.
What, for the platoon sergeant that is stepping into that role, we're at that point in your story. Things that, you know, maybe you did bad, you did good, don't do this like me, do this, you know, what, any tips, tricks, anything there?
So the key thing with a new lieutenant as a platoon sergeant is they're going to come in and they've been taught at West Point or at their ROTC program that you are expected to lead when you come in. They're also told that, you know, are taught that you are expected to learn and you're expected to trust your NCOs when you come in. So what I would always try to do as a platoon sergeant is I would prop up my platoon leader and get them to understand that you are in charge of this platoon, but I'm going to make sure that you are successful, and I'm going to make sure you're not going to fail. I said, the company commander, who is your raider, is going to make you a great officer. I'm going to make you a great platoon leader.
Ooh, that's good.
Yeah, and that's what I went out to do. Now, I will tell you, I've got lieutenants that got scar tissue. The guy I got, a West Pointer, and when I was a platoon sergeant in the 82nd, this was when I was a sergeant first class, my second go-around coming back from Germany. This guy was a hardhead. Mm. And the culture then in the 82nd was when you got on Ardennes Street, the main road running down the 82nd footprint, that you didn't bullshit around out there.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, when you would run down there, if you were slacking or half-stepping, there'd be other organizations talking shit to you. And it could get, you know, almost violent at times.
Yeah.
And I used to tell my platoon leader, or my platoon, you know, prior to this lieutenant coming there, we're going to go get 7 guide-ons today on the run. Now, I wouldn't say this is the pace we're going to run at, or how we're going to go get 7 guide-ons, meaning we are going to pass up at least 7 company-sized organizations. And if we have to, we're going to steal their guide-on from them. Okay? So that told you the kind of pace we were going to run
at. Right.
Okay? So my lieutenant comes in, this new lieutenant, and I'm trying to explain to him, sir, you're going to lead this run. We're going to be at your pace, but we pass guide-ons here. So I won't tell you how fast to run,
right?
But do not embarrass us out on this run. And so we get out on Ardennes Street, and we're running down the road as a platoon. I'm calling cadence out there, and one of my squad leaders getting ready to replace me and everything, and we are moving out. I'm talking, we're like at a 7-minute mile. And we passed up 1 or 2 units, talking shit to them and everything. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing my lieutenant's head going back and then going down. And all of a sudden, he was starting to slow down. And I'm telling him, all right, let's go, sir. Let's go, sir. And he's slowing down. And all of a sudden, we got a unit right up on our ass that is talking shit to us. Hey, you pansies, get the hell out of the way and all this. And pretty soon, I'm like, lieutenant, you're about to embarrass us. This unit's about to pass us up. And he breaks out of the formation, and he starts walking on the side of the road.
Uh-oh.
And I said, you got to be shitting me. You're falling out of the run that you're setting the pace at? I said, let's go, boys. And we just took off like bats out of hell. And as we're going down Ardennes, I hear this voice, Sergeant Troxel, make sure you stretch them out when you get back. It was a lieutenant giving me guidance to stretch out the paratroopers when I get back. I said, this dude is going to get his ass beat when he gets back here, all right? And so we finish the run and everything and stretch out, let the troops go. And when he finally shows back up, I bring him off to the side. And I said, Lieutenant, do not ever embarrass you, yourself, our platoon, or try to embarrass me ever again, okay? Because the worst thing that can happen to you is that you break the trust between me and you and what I'm going to do to make you a successful platoon leader, because I'll put you on roller skates then, and we'll continue to be the best platoon in this battalion with you or without you. So don't ever do that again. And you never fall out of a run that you're setting the pace at. If you don't think you can hold the pace on Ardennes that is needed to be able to show these other units that we're better than them, then we won't run on Ardennes until you can, all right? And he understood, but in the end, that guy ended up, you know, getting himself on his own proverbial roller skates, and he didn't make it, you know.
All right, so now.
Sorry, I had to get that out.
No, you're good. Now I'm going to throw a little curveball.
Yeah.
If you were to be in that situation today after serving in the positions that you did, same kind of situation,
yep.
same deal, same organizational culture, everything. I'm not going to say, you know, today in 2023. So now with your experiences that you have, would you approach that the same? Would you approach it differently? You know,
I would approach it the same.
Okay.
But I probably would have had a lot of repercussions from that.
Well, no. Like, I'm asking, so, you know, looking at it as an opportunity to teach, coach, mentor.
Yeah.
Right. You know, would you, after the experiences of moving up, you know, would you?
Oh, yeah. I'm not talking about all that stuff.
I'm talking about, like, the growing of that lieutenant.
I would have done it differently.
Okay.
First of all, I should have blamed myself on this because I didn't do any homework on this lieutenant. I should have said, okay, Lieutenant, you know, what's your 2-mile time? You know, you did a pre-ranger assessment at West Point and at your basic course. So what was your 5-mile time? I should have done a little homework to make sure that he was able to do this. But the guy was like a buck 40, all right? Yeah. I was 215 pounds, and we were running 7-minute miles for 5, 6, 7 miles as a platoon, you know? So I would have probably done my homework a little better and understood the capabilities of him before I put him in a position that ultimately embarrassed himself and you know, potentially embarrassed me,
mm-hmm.
and the platoon. But I would have done it a little different in terms of being a little more understanding and, you know, trying to really draw out the best things in him. But, you know, at the time, like I said, in that battalion,
he was a
goldfish in a tank full of piranha. And I was trying to get him to perform as a piranha, and he didn't have the capacity to do that. So
And you know, I wasn't saying that to question how you did it.
No, I got it.
Like, I wanted the reflective of, hey, you know, I mean, you were the senior enlisted guy in the entire military, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, now, you know, like, so, no, you hit the nail on the head, though, right? Like, do your homework. Like, know this person.
Yeah.
You know, you can ask some questions without having to spend, you know, 15 hours on Google.
Yeah.
Right? You can know, like, all right, here's kind of the capabilities through some guiding questions. And are you expecting them to do something that is unrealistic? Right?
Yeah.
And that's what you said. And that's a great point, you know, for NCOs that are getting their first lieutenants because,
yeah,
you know, lieutenants that come out of West Point, ROTC programs, OCS, they're all different.
Yeah.
Because they're not trained the same there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Bullocks are trying to get them to a same standard. But,
yeah,
you know, you only have so much time.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a great, great, like, green notebook moment.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Cool. Thanks for sharing that with me.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so 82nd, we're back there. Wait a minute.
We came back to the 82nd. Yep. And then, you know, I was selected for the Sergeant Major's Academy, and I graduated class 51.
What year is this?
2001.
By the way, I've gotten in trouble for not asking what year things happen because people like to connect where they were. When.
So, 92 to 95 was Germany. I talked about 95 to 99, back in the 82nd, I was a platoon sergeant. Then I was a first sergeant over in the ground recce troop of the 1st Squadron, 17th Cavalry. And from there, I was selected for the Sergeant Major's Academy. I did a little time at ROTC there, Campbell University, too, but not long, because the minute I got there, I was selected for the academy, and I left shortly after to go to school down at Fort Bliss.
Isn't their mascot like a camel or something?
Yeah. The yeah. Campbell Camels. Yeah.
Nice. All right, so Sergeant Major's Academy, were you there during 9/11?
I was.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, the morning of 9/11, I had already graduated the academy, and I was now, I was a command sergeant major select, so I was waiting for, you know, a position to come open from the Army on where I would be a command sergeant major at. So I was working at Joint Task Force 6 doing counter drug at that headquarters. Mm-hmm. And I was out that morning on a run in the desert, and as I was running, all of a sudden I saw these commercial airplanes coming in very low altitude and landing, multiple aircraft landing at the El Paso International Airport. And I was like, what the hell is going on here?
Right.
So I turned around to go back to my headquarters to see if something was going on. And as I got in and walked into our cafeteria kind of conference break room there, the big TV was on, and tower number one was on fire. And as I was standing there seeing this, all of a sudden a plane flew into tower number two. And I'm like, okay, this is not an accident. And I had, you know, being a two-time combat vet, I was constantly studying the enemies. And I had been intrigued about these terrorists from, you know, the Beirut attack in 83 to the TWA flight 847 in 85, the discotheque in Berlin bombing in 86, and the things that had been going on, the first World Trade Center bombing mm-hmm. in 93, and then Khobar Towers bombing and everything. And I had been studying more on Al-Qaeda and these terrorist organizations, you know, and the Palestinian Front for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and all these folks. So the minute that second aircraft hit that tower, I said, this is Al-Qaeda. I guarantee you, and this is Osama bin Laden. I knew it right away that this was what it was. And I knew then that the world we lived in now was going to change, and that we as a military were going to go and be an expeditionary military to get after these non-state actors. Mm-hmm. And that's when our whole world changed, as we all know, and the direction of our military changed from where we were looking to, you know, from the Cold War to the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Bosnia, you know, Herzegovina stuff. Now, all of a sudden, we were going to go back into places like Iraq and, well, Afghanistan initially, but then Iraq to get after these terrorists, to get after these non-state actors that might potentially have weapons of mass destruction and everything. And I knew that, hey, this is what it's going to be. And I even told my wife at the time, okay, whenever I become a command sergeant major here in the near future, I'm probably going to go to combat right away. You know, I don't know whether it's going to be Afghanistan, but this is going to be our world we lived in. And then certainly that's exactly what happened.
All right. So where was that unit?
It was 3rd Squadron, 17th Cavalry, 10th Mountain Division.
Okay.
Now, the 10th Mountain Division in Fort Drum was some of the initial units that had went in right after 9/11.
Correct. Operation Anaconda.
Operation Anaconda, absolutely. But throughout my 2 years there, the vast majority of the division was in Afghanistan. My unit, 3rd Squadron, 17th Cavalry, and 1st Battalion, 32nd Infantry, out of 2nd Brigade, were in Iraq. So we went to Iraq, and I went into Mosul with the 3rd Striker Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, with a guy named Rob Choppa, who is now, you know, heads of the Infantry Association and yes, the sir. Museum and everything. Yeah. So, yeah, and that was where, you know, my first combat for Iraqi freedom was.
So it's interesting. All right, so you guys were attached to them.
Yes.
Rolling in. All right, so we had Colonel Damian Mason on, mm-hmm. and Damian was Bravo Company commander in that he did the big run from, like, Talifar all the way down in those Strikers. So did you guys have Strikers too, or?
No, I was an air cavalry squadron. So we provided OH-58 Delta support, and then I created because my ground troop that I had in that squadron was attached to 1st Brigade, and they were in Afghanistan. So I created a hodgepodge platoon called the Wolverines, you know, from,
Red Dawn.
Red Dawn, yeah. And then they were not only my battlefield security, but they also did limited reconnaissance operations while we were there. And that's where I was running around. I didn't have a striker. I had a Humvee with no doors in a heavily infested IED environment.
Yeah. So how'd that work out?
So you drive fast. You limit your footprint. I mean, the four Humvees I would have, we would be doing 60 mile an hour on the roads in the wrong direction on the highways.
Yeah.
And we would be almost bumper to bumper as we were driving. And then when we would get into Mosul and it would be crowded with vehicles and everything, we would get up on the sidewalks. We would drive there. Little traffic circles where there was a lot of IEDs. Mm-hmm. Instead of driving around the traffic circle, we'd drive over the top, you know, and four-wheel our way. We looked for different methods to make sure that we had the competitive advantage over the enemy in terms of our ability to react and everything. And that's where, you know, Rob Choppa, you know, earned his Purple Heart out there. They got into a firefight, him and his TAC, and I just happened upon him, you know, in my Humvee, you know, and with no doors. And I got out, and I carried a Mossberg 500 with me. Because here, this is another thing of being an armor guy supporting infantrymen. So when I would go out on patrol, and the reason I would go out on patrol with the infantrymen is because I wanted to see how our OH-58 Deltas were supporting them, you know, with reconnaissance, eyes forward, suppressive aircraft, suppressive fire and everything. And so having a shotgun with me, every time they got ready to go into a house or something and the door was locked, I'd come up and be the breacher, and I'd blow the hinges off the damn door and everything, you know? And then people would say, hey, get that 10th Mountain CSM up here to freaking blow the hatches off this door and everything, you know? So that's why. And so that was when, you know, Choppa and him, they got hit by a three-point ambush.
Yeah.
And an AK-47 round came over the top, hit the sandbags in front of Choppa was in the commander's hatch. And the bullet whizzed by his eye. And, you know, the energy with that bullet, thank God it didn't hit him, but right. It just tore his face up.
Yeah.
And here he was in the ditch taking fire because they had chased the enemy into this wooded area there, in northern Mosul. And as I got out of my Humvee and walked over there, and here's Choppa in a fighting position, and he looks like Ric Flair because he's got blood on his face and everything, and I'm like, hey, sir, what the hell are you doing laying in the ditch here? He's like, well, we were chasing the enemy, you know, and everything. And
he's so, a lieutenant colonel at this point,
he's a
right?
lieutenant colonel. He's a post-battalion command. He is the deputy commander of 3rd Striker Brigade, 2ID. And so he and I had a phenomenal relationship there. And as there would be times that he would go out on mission. He'd allow me to ride in the air guard hatch of his striker and everything. But the point there was, and the point that I give to leaders is battlefield presence, leader presence is absolutely critical. And it's not so much, are you at the right place at the right time doing the right things? Are you at the points of friction? But are you at places where you can have an impact as a leader and not micromanaging or anything like that? Here I was I was moving to brigade headquarters at that time to come in and get my sit rep from the Brigade S2 and from the MI company on what the enemy was doing. And I hear this call over there that the Brigade TAC is in contact, and they're in a tick with the enemy. And I'm like, those are my good buddies, Rob Choppa, the deputy commander, Jeff Dew, the Brigade CSM, who's just another legend in the infantry world. And I said, I'm here, you know, and I've got firepower. I got four Humvees with 50 cals on them and rifles and everything. And so I drove to where the site was, you know, where they were in
65 miles an hour,
65 miles an hour, bumper to bumper. And when we pulled up, we did our little logger, you know, we herringboned on the road where Humvees, you know, 50 cals. And then me and my dismounts, we got on the ground and went over there to help them out. But the point in all of that is, as an armor guy with an external unit, an air cavalry squadron assigned to an infantry brigade, how do I fit in? How do I show the value that I and my people can be? And so it was acts like that where I would show up to help somebody like a Rob Chopper, or I would take the Wolverines and tell the infantry battalions, give me a limited reconnaissance target that you may not have the firepower or manpower to get after, and I'll give it to the Wolverines, and we'll get out there, and we'll study the target. We'll do whatever is needed. And so the more I showed value like that, our organization was more accepted into this infantry brigade, even though we weren't an infantry unit.
Yeah, and it's all about how can I help?
Yep,
yeah,
absolutely.
How can I be a combat multiplier?
Yeah.
You know, those type things.
Yeah. And, you know, the good news about that, Brian, is so after that deployment, I came back and I took over the 2nd Stryker Cavalry Regiment. And the minute I got to Fort Polk, Louisiana at the time, I was told, hey, your organization is moving to Fort Lewis, Washington, which is the home of 3rd Stryker Brigade 2ID, and you're going to transform into a Stryker Brigade. So here I was working with a Stryker Brigade in combat for a year, and I was like, man, if I could ever own one of these things, it'd be great. Well, now I was going to be a Stryker Brigade Command Sergeant Major, and we transformed from 2nd Stryker Cavalry Regiment to 4th Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division. And so here I was an armor guy, the first armored guy that was a Stryker Infantry Brigade Command Sergeant Major. And I took it to the surge in Iraq as Surge Brigade number 4.
Wow. We've covered a lot of ground in an hour.
Yeah.
All right. So, hey, here we go. Surge. Surge number 4.
It was, so I think everybody knows what the surge was about. It was President Bush's way of trying to overcome the quasi-civil war that was going on by the Shia and the Sunni, and how Al-Qaeda in Iraq and other organizations, terrorist organizations, were using that to continue to cause unrest within the Iraqi people and everything. And so I was Surge Brigade number 4. We went into the northern Baghdad belt, and we went into an area that didn't have a lot of U.S. forces when we went in there, and so we took a lot of casualties coming in because we weren't accustomed to the fight on the battlefield and the enemy hadn't been tested there in a while. And so it was when my brigade TAC, we got hit. John Lair was my commander, Colonel John Lair, career infantryman, former Ranger Regiment guy, retired as a brigadier general. But he and I, our convoy got hit by an Iranian explosive foreign penetrator. And it killed one of our security guys, Corporal Brandon Craig, severely wounded our fire support officer at the time, Major Daniel Dudek, wounded a bunch of our other guys. But what it did is it caused Lair and I to reflect on, we got to get out of these strikers. The enemy has the advantage because they own the terrain and they know how to fight against these strikers. And so when he came in to me and said, hey, what are we going to do? I said, sir, we need to get the fuck out of these strikers, and we need to hit the enemy in their support zones, in their security zones. We need to take the fight to them. And I had a great operations officer there, another former Ranger Regiment infantryman, Major Mike Katona. He's now Colonel Mike Katona, and he's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Legislative Affairs Advisor now. But he came up with this concept along with our S2, Pat Mackin, called Raider Strike. We were going to take our Raider Brigade, we were going to take infantry platoons, reconnaissance platoons, put them on helicopters every night, and we were going to go after high-value targets. We were chasing bad cell phones, and we were getting after the enemy in their support zones, in their security zones, going beyond those improvised explosive devices in their support zones and everything to hit them in their backyard. And we started having a huge impact. And when it was all said and done, we had killed or captured 250 high-value targets, Al-Qaeda leaders, financiers, and IED makers. The highest number of HVIs that had been killed or captured by any brigade-sized organization during the Iraqi war. And guess what? Over time, all of a sudden, we weren't taking casualties anymore. Mm-hmm. We were inflicting casualties on the enemy. We were empowering the CLS, we called them, CLCs, Concerned Local Citizens, where we would arm these Iraqi forces. They'd wear a PT belt. They'd have an AK-47. And all of a sudden, they were taking control of the neighborhoods. We were empowering the government of Diyala Province and the leaders, the local leaders there, law enforcement and everything. And we were engaging with the population, the most critical part of the battlefield. And the battlefield started changing on us. And it got a lot safer for us. And we had a lot of impact. And we had a lot of momentum. And by the time we got done, the last 3 months of that deployment, we lost not one soldier. Over the 15 months out of that 4,000 man and woman brigade, we lost 54 and had 500 severely wounded. But most of that was up front. And when we adapted to the battlefield and the enemy's tactics, and we continued to hit them where they didn't think we had the ability to hit them, it had a huge impact. And that is what I took when I left there. And I left there and I became the U.S. Army Armor Center, CSM, after we redeployed. And I wanted our armor force to be able to be that kind of dynamic, like the infantry force, the infantry school was doing and everything, to build this kind of disciplined initiative into the force to understand that doctrine says one thing, but the enemy is what you got to fight, not doctrine sometimes. Mm. And you have to adjust to what the enemy's doing and what the battlefield's doing. And that's the kind of focus I took to the Armor Center after that.
Yeah, and there's a General Dupuy quote when he was doing the whole TRADOC rebuild and all that. And he talks about operating or changing, the organizational change needs to happen at a ruthless pace.
Absolutely.
And that is exactly what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
You know, that whole how we get after training and problems, you know, it takes years for things to get corrected. And
you can't move in low transfer in an LMTV and expect that you're going to pass up any enemy. You got to be in high transfer and you got to be moving out.
We got to go grab some guidons.
Absolutely. We got to get 7 guidons today, you know.
Yeah.
We need to have the initiative and the advantage over any threat.
That's I'm going to have to remember that.
Yeah.
I may need to get a guidon and get you to sign it and say 7 guidons a day. That's awesome. All right.
As you described, we got to run with scissors.
Yeah.
That's what it is, you know, and not be afraid of doing it. Not be risk averse, not be risk reckless, but be risk savvy in how we do that. And risk savvy means that we understand the threat. We understand its capabilities. We know what our capabilities are, and let's go get after it.
Yeah.
All right? And ask for forgiveness later.
There's some people that are going to pass out when I say this because I'm a huge Auburn guy. But Patrick Murphy, the softball coach at Alabama,
yeah,
great American. I love Patrick to death. He mentored me when I was a young coach. But one of the things he said that stuck with me is we want to be aggressive. We don't want to be stupid aggressive.
Right.
And that's exactly what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
You know, go be aggressive. Go run. Know your left and right limits. And sometimes I test those.
And that's okay.
Right. I hope everybody feels that way.
Well, I will tell you, my concern, you know, I spend a lot of time with the force now in all the services. Being a former SEAC, I spend a lot of time with the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guards, Space Force, everybody, Active Guard and Reserve. And my fear is that if you are aggressive now, if you are moving with a rapid sense of purpose, and sometimes that can be frowned upon because we are trying, and I get what we're trying to do with people first and everything, but we are trying to move at a speed that everybody can keep up.
Mm.
And guess what? The enemy moves faster than that.
Mm.
Okay, so we have to continue to build these competitive advantages, and we have to build ways that we can retain initiatives if we go into a fight with a communist China or Russia or North Korea, Iran, or with terrorists again, or whatever emerging threats are, and have that level of aggression and that sense of purpose and urgency that is necessary. And you can't just wake up one morning when the balloon has gone up and say, well, we're going to have this sense of urgency and everything, and we're going to be aggressive about what we do. If you ain't doing it in training, it ain't going to happen in combat.
Yeah.
Period. You know?
That's a great point. No, that's, I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
Like how getting after those things. So you were the Armor School CSM.
The Armor Center.
Armor Center CSM.
Yep.
All right. Patton Museum. Great place, by the way. We got to go visit it last year. And then what happens? There's a move that happens.
So the Armor School, which was one of my subordinates, you know, which was the Command Sergeant Major there, was a guy named Ricky Young, who close personal friend of mine, great warfighter, a guy that had some heavy fighting in the northern Baghdad belt himself. He brought the Armor School down as the Armor School CSM. And my job went away. And at that point in time, it was like, I either find another job or I got to retire. Well, Army Accessions Command, which used to be the three-star command that was responsible for Army recruiting, ROTC, and a mission support brigade that had the Golden Knights, the Army Marksmanship Unit, and stuff like that. That job was coming open, and the commander was a great general officer named Lieutenant General Ben Frakely, former 10th Mountain Division commander, one of these leaders that lived by being aggressive, having a sense of urgency, risk savvy, and all of these things. And he asked me to put my name on the slate, you know. And so when a general tells you to do that, and he's a selecting official, you know what's going to happen. And so I got selected for Army Accessions Command. And a year later, though, it went away. So I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? And the first corps position at Joint Base Lewis-McChord had come open, and I had been a striker brigade CSM there. So I put my name on the slate. I'm already at the three-star level, so I don't know whether I'm going to get selected or not. But I get a call. I was actually here at the former Fort Benning visiting the Army Marksmanship Unit when I got the call from General Scaparotti, and he said, hey, I've selected you to be my Sergeant Major at First Corps. So now I knew what I was doing, and First Corps was heading to Afghanistan to be the three-star level headquarters there, responsible for day-to-day combat. So now I was fired up, you know. Not only was Sandra and I, my wife and I, heading back to where a place we love, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Washington, but I was going back into the fight, and I was happy about that. And we got there, did a little train-up, and ended up going to Afghanistan for a year, serving as the three-star level headquarters, and initiating the beginning of the withdrawal out of Afghanistan. This was during the surge in Afghanistan. We had about 110,000, 120,000 troops in Afghanistan at that time. And in the year I was there, we got it down below 100,000.
And what year was that?
11 and 12.
Okay.
2011 and 12. Still a lot of hard fighting going on. We lost 332 U.S. and coalition troops in that year that were killed in action. 233 were Americans. That shows you the level of combat throughout the entire theater that was still going on. And in the
That's
north...
That's almost one a day.
It is. Yeah. In the northeast, you know, in Nuristan and places like that, in Jalalabad and places like that, it was like direct combat. Redwood forest fighting, you know, or we had these bases that were in valleys, you know, huge mistakes doing that, and the enemy, you know, could put plunging fire on. And in southern Afghanistan, it was, you know, the knee-deep dust and everything and the grape rows and stuff like that. So it was a non-metallic improvised explosive device fight down there. Okay, so when you would go to the, you know, the prosthetic clinic in Walter Reed, 90% of all of the casualties there had served in either Kandahar or Helmand Province. They were a soldier or Marine that had done that. Gunshot wounds generally served in, you know, the northeastern part of the country or in the eastern part of the country where it was more direct fighting. But it was huge, the level of combat that was going on there at that time. And so for a year, that's what I did. And I did the same thing I've always done as a senior enlisted leader, circulate the battlefield to gain the pulse of the force and deliver the why to the troops. And that included going on target with the Rangers, going on target with our Naval Special Operations Forces, our elite Army Special Operations Forces, because, again, I wanted them to understand, even though you're special operators and you have a special mission, over the overall picture, you're a part of the big picture. And I wanted them to understand what we were trying to do at the operational and strategic level to gain the advantages and to continue to build on successes in Afghanistan. So 6 days out of the week, I was on the all over that country.
Yeah. And so we had Jeff Mellinger on.
Yeah.
And he was at Iraq, I think maybe the year before this or 2 years before this.
No, he was in Iraq for 3 years, 04 to 07.
Okay, yeah, so it was way before this. But, like, he was on the road constantly.
Constantly.
Right? And because Iraq's different than Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know, and some of our audience may not know that. So Jeff was circulating in his Humvees. And,
yep.
And how were you circulating around Afghanistan?
I was going by helicopter. And then I would get out to the units, and then I would be on foot.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because the vast part of Afghanistan, I mean, it took you one day to drive from, you know, from Kabul to Kandahar, you know, because there was only Highway 1 that's encircled. That was the only main road that you can get anywhere. Iraq was a little bit more trafficable. I mean, in Iraq, both of my tours there, the first one I was on a Humvee with no doors. That's how I got around. Second time around, I was in a Stryker combat vehicle, you know. But think of this. Jeff Mellinger, and he was one of my mentors. Jeff Mellinger, in 3 years, traveled that entire country to visit the troops, to gain the pulse of the force, deliver the why from his strategic operational headquarters. And in the terms, I don't know what the exact number is. I've heard 34 times in 3 years he's been blown up.
Yeah, he tells the number.
Yeah, but think of that, almost once a month. So it wasn't if, it was when. When you say, I as the senior enlisted leader, this is my responsibility to get out with the troops, that I'm going to accept these risks and I'm going to get after it, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the same way with me. Both times that, you know, I got blown up, it was out doing battlefield circulation as a command sergeant major, you know? And so it's just inherent with what you do, you know?
He brings up, like, the Pope glass. You know, were there any soldier innovations that you saw that you were like, yep, we need to
put? Yes. Well, so that, the Pope glass. So on a Stryker, you know, commander's hatch, we were able to put it here in front of the commander and on the side, and you had a spot over here that was open that you could put your rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we had a little mount that the soldiers developed that I could sit my rifle on, that I could accurately, on the move, shoot my weapon and be lethal with it, you know? Things like that we would do, you know? There was a lot of innovation that went on that troops got after, you know, to make it, you know, I will tell you, when I was a Stryker Brigade Sergeant Major in Iraq in 07 and 08 in the surge, and this may, we may not have been the first ones to do that, but my guys would be up on a roof, one of my infantry platoons, and they were taking fire, and they were trying to identify where the fire was coming from, and they would always have this stick with them that had this little ball on the end of it, and they would stick a helmet on it, and then and made it look like a human face, and they would run that up.
Yeah.
And while they were undercover, when the enemy would fire, then they would know where the fire was at, and they were able to call in suppressive mortar fire or put effective machine gun fire on that enemy target.
That's an old school, like, Revolutionary War tactic, right?
That's exactly right.
But you want a new idea, read an old book.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and again, it's all about how do you gain advantages over your enemy. And the focus has got to be not only how do I survive combat, but how do I thrive and how do I win? Even though I might be in a fight like Afghanistan that went 20 years, and we certainly, in the year that a unit was going to be there, we're not going to defeat the Taliban, but how do I put desired effects on the enemy that gets after what we're trying to do, but more importantly, sets conditions that will be easier for the unit that replaces me?
Yeah.
And the units that did that over there were hugely successful. And you know what? They had the least amount of casualties because they were taking the fight to the enemy.
Yeah.
Some people think that you get into a forward operating base and you just hunker down and pull security that, you know, you're probably safer and everything. That's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, because they're planning on how to get in there at that point.
Well, and then the enemy owns you. They have you neutralized, okay, and that you can't get in or out, you know.
Yeah.
The units that took the fight to the enemy and put the enemy on their heels generally had the least amount of casualties, you know. And don't get me wrong, the enemy gets a vote, and the best units, the most lethal units, are going to have casualties and everything.
Yeah.
But they certainly weren't as much as when you would just sit back and say, well, if we just hunker down, nobody will get hurt and we'll be okay.
Yeah.
That's the absolute wrong way to go about combat.
Interesting. That's a good point. So First Corps.
Yeah, I left First Corps after that, and I became the U.S. Forces Korea Command Sergeant Major. So now here I went from high-end combat, phase 4 and 5 of operations that we called it back then, and now here I'm in Korea doing phase 0 and 1. We are shaping and deterring and trying to maintain armistice conditions on the Korean Peninsula. So I spent a lot of time as the U.S. Forces Korea working for another guy named Scaparotti, okay, who's now a 4-star and the boss there. Spent a lot of time with the ROC military. I mean, I spent so much time with the ROC military. Hanguko chogum hamnida, taraso yongoro malha kesupnita, kamsamnida. I mean, I can speak Hangul now, you know, and Junan Troxil, John Wayne, Yuan Sa, Yan Hapsa, Juan Migunsa, Chuimon Saimnida, Bankap Supnida. You know, so, I mean, I was so good at that because I spent the vast majority of my time with the ROC 1st and 4th Army. because I had 8th Army Sergeant Major, a good old Ranger infantryman, Ray Devins, and then followed by a legend in the Ranger community, Rick Merritt, that was in charge of 8th Army. And so I let them run with that. And then I had other senior enlisted leader for the other U.S. forces that were responsible. So my focus was on building the coalition at that level. The sending states under the United Nations command that we were in charge of, the 17 unit there, but more importantly, under the Combined Forces Command, which included the ROCs, building that with the ROCs. And I spent time in the Northwest Islands where I was closer to Pyongyang, North Korea, mm-hmm. than I was Seoul, South Korea. Yeah. In the far eastern part of the country on the DMZ, where those Korean troops had not seen an American in 2 years, I did those kinds of things to continue to not only bring credibility to our command, but let them know that, hey, we get it, that you're out here, and you're the first line of defense if all of a sudden armistice conditions go out the way. And this proved so valuable, Brian, in August of 2015, when we were in the middle of Olchi Freedom Guardian, was the big exercise mm-hmm. we did. And we were in our command post Tango, we called it. We were in the side of the mountain there. Our headquarters was up and everything. And one day this Korean recon patrol, South Korean, was doing its normal patrol, and they had went into the DMZ, opened the gate and went in. And in the middle of the night, North Korean Special Operations Forces had emplaced box mines there, non-metallic, improvised explosive devices. It buried them right there. And so this squad went in there, and the first NCO, Staff Sergeant Haas, steps on one of these mines, boom, becomes a bilateral amputee. Staff Sergeant Kim, the guy behind him, runs up to assist him. Kim steps on an IED. Boom, he's a single-leg amputee. That event right there, all of a sudden now, we were escalating. The South mm-hmm. Koreans and North Koreans were escalating. Mm-hmm. They were doing artillery fire across each other on the DMZ. They were firing, machine gun fire and everything. The North Koreans deployed all 73 of their submarines at that point in time along the northern limit line. And all of a sudden, we thought the Korean War is about to kick in again.
Here we go.
But were it not for the efforts of General Scaparotti, the ambassador there, our teammates at U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, and obviously the chairman and the Secretary of Defense at the time, we could have had the Korean War resuming again. But we got it tamped back down, and we got the North Koreans to push back off again, But more importantly, we kept the ROCs from doing something that would be completely stupid and that would cause the Korean War, the resumption of hostilities. But again,
because you talk about aggressive.
Yeah.
The ROCs, yeah. I mean, they are notorious.
Aggressive as hell. Yeah. And you do something to them, they're going to come after
you. It's on.
So here we are in the command post, and General Scap is getting this loads of information coming his way. And here's, on the ROC side, the chairman of the ROC Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Lee, was talking directly to the platoon leader, the lieutenant, on the ground. Think of that. That would be like General Milley right now talking to some lieutenant in Poland to find out what's going on and just circumventing layers of chain of command. And so Scaparotti wanted to know, no shit, what is going on up there? And he just looked at me. Now, I had been this guy's sergeant major for 4.5 years in 3 different assignments. Excuse me. And he just gives me that look. And I said, General Scap, I'll be there tomorrow. First thing, at first light, I'll be there. So I went to the site on the DMZ where this happened, and I had my Korean driver, my Katusa, and my ops NCO, a guy named Juan Byers, with me. And we go up there, and we go out and patrol with that same platoon again because I wanted to see how they were, having 2 guys that were wounded. And then we got out there and started doing things along the DMZ because I wanted to see what the enemy was. And get situational understanding so I could deliver that back to my boss so that he understood exactly what was going on the ground there. And who did I learn that from? Jeff Mellinger. When Mellinger, for 3 years in combat, would go everywhere. And I learned it from another guy, an armor guy here, Roger Blackwood, who was the former 1st Armored Division Command Sergeant Major and retired as the U.S. Army Cyber Command Sergeant Major. Blackwood was the same way. Leader presence, go to the points of friction, get out there and get the pulse of what's going on, deliver that back to the boss, but more importantly, deliver to the troops what the boss and the senior staff is doing to get after that. And so...
Two-way communication.
And so then, 3 months later, I'm on the slate for the SEAC. And General Dunford, who Marine General Dunford, comes over to do his normal interactions with the ROC military and everything. And he interviews me there in a cafe in the Marriott Hotel. He does the interview for me to be the SEAC. And I could tell we hit it off right away. Here's this fighting Joe Dunford, you know, leader of the 5th Marines during the invasion into Iraq, and then chief of staff of the 1st Marine Division as they continued to put the scunion on the enemy and everything. And, you know, fighting Joe was, that's his nickname, you know. And we just hit it off. And, you know, it was 2 weeks later he called me. And this is what I love about General Dunford. He doesn't call me and say, hey, I've selected you to be the next senior enlisted advisor to the chairman, the senior enlisted guy in the DOD. He calls me, and I happened to be in Japan at the time visiting the Japanese ground self-defense forces. And he calls me at my hotel, the Nusano Hotel in Tokyo, and he says, hey, I'm glad you're doing that circulation, you know, with the joint and combined forces and everything. That's important. He says, well, if you and Sandra, my wife Sandra, if you and Sandra are up for it, my wife Ellen and I would love for you to come and be our teammates here in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
I mean, you talk about, I mean, I was ready to, you know, push through hell for that guy right then. The way he approached that.
Yep.
And when I got there and took over as the SEAC, the first thing he talked to me about was, I don't need you in the Pentagon. I need you out telling me what's going on with the force. And then here's another thing that was interesting, because so many senior enlisted leaders feel like they got to be greased by their boss to know that they're doing good things. Mm-hmm. And Dunford told me, don't expect me to tell you whether you're doing a good job or not. He says, I'll know if you're doing a good job by what the force tells me. Mm. And he says, so don't, if you're waiting for me to tell you what to do, you're going to be waiting for 4 years. And if you're waiting around for me to tell you you're doing a good job, he said, if you're getting after it every day and after 4 years you're retiring, he said, you're probably doing a great job. And I love that because I didn't need my boss to pat me on the back or anything. What I needed him to do was give me clear vision and guidance and autonomy that I could go out and do the things necessary. So I spent my time in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, Colombia, the Korean Peninsula, in Indonesia, places like this.
With all forces.
I mean, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, Coast Guard, all forces. And it was just the time of my life because what I had been doing at a micro level as I grew up was now at the ultimate macro level where Dunford holds up a globe to me and says, this is our battle space. Get after it. Mm. And it was just awesome. And because I built a great team with the service senior enlisted and the combatant command senior enlisted, it made it that much easier. And not only did Dunford allow me to do that, I wanted to put an enlisted spin on what we were doing strategically. So I started doing biannual press conferences with the Pentagon Press Corps. I would do conferences twice a year with all those enlisted, the top 20 in all the forces, and we would visit the White House, the administrations, key leaders there at the White House, with Congress, with the State Department. I wanted the people to understand that our number one greatest competitive advantage was our enlisted force. And Dunford was the guy that gave me the autonomy to do that. But more importantly, Dunford was the guy that would put me in front of key leaders around the world that, you know, I would be there with him and everything. And the same thing, Scaparotti used to do the same thing for me. And so the lesson I'm trying to give there, sometimes senior enlisted leaders, they feel like they've got to be standing, their power base is standing next to their boss, and there are certainly times that you have to be standing next to your general or flag officer whenever they're doing something. But the best senior enlisted leader you can be for your boss is being where he ain't or she ain't, you know, and giving them the pulse of things that they need to know, but they don't have the ability to go and see for themselves. And so I found myself a lot in places like Somalia, you know, where not a lot of people are at, Libya, Yemen, all these places that people are like, well, what are we doing there? Well, we're fighting our asses off with our you know, our special operations forces and stuff like that. So that's, and then, you know, I did that, and that's where the eTool thing came out.
Yeah, and so I don't want to get into the aftermath of that.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, like, how did you get to that point? And then we'll wrap everything up, and then I have a mad minute, because we're rolling about an hour and a half.
Yeah. So what came about that is right after I took over as the SEAC, and, you know, man, I'm fired up. I'm getting after it. I want to learn, you know, because when you go to the Pentagon at that level and you're at the ultimate level of the Department of Defense, coming from the field into that is like going from Division I college football to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
The speed of the game is much faster, and you have to catch up to the speed of the game. And the more you catch up to it, the game slows down, and you start getting situational understanding, and you get better at your job. And so there was a meeting going on with the National Security the President's National Security Council, one of their deputy subcommittee groups. These are like staffers that get after hard subjects and everything and provide recommendations to the cabinet member that they can brief the president on.
Was McMaster leading it? No, he wasn't in SA.
He was the National Security Advisor for a time.
Okay.
Not when I first got there. The first year, it was the last year of the Obama administration.
Right.
So anyways, I go to this meeting with a very influential general. He wasn't in the Army. And he and I were the only two military guys that went to this meeting. And I'm sitting around all these staffers, and some of them are young, PhDs and stuff like this. And we're talking about how to have effects on terrorists beyond the, you know, combat and taking them out and everything like that. And so we're having this conversation, and this young staffer sitting next to me, young lady, she stands up and says, well, I'll tell you how we get after this. Instead of killing these people, we need to give them a job. And I thought to myself, okay, vast majority of these terrorists aren't doing this because they're living in poverty. Now, don't get me wrong. Somalia, Libya, places like that, Eastern Africa, you know, Al-Shabaab terrorist organization, they recruit young military-age males because they want to take care of their family. And they need a job, you know. But I thought the terrorists we're fighting in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, the vast majority of them are driven by radical ideology, and they come from Belgium, from France, from Germany, from the UK, from the US, yes. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, places like this. And they aren't doing it because they're starving to death. They're doing it because they fully believe in this radical ideology, and they are there to kill the infidels, the United States. And so I explained this to this young lady, you know, and I could tell that the reaction from the room was, people were like, you know, either this guy knows what he's talking about and we're a bunch of jerks, or he's a jerk and our way is the way.
Right.
And it might have been the latter at that time based on the administration. No disrespect to anybody. But I realized then that we were not looking at what was going on around the world with our troops here in Washington, D.C., the way we should have. You know, as a matter of fact, it was a year and a half that I was in as the SEAC when we had the attack in Niger, where four special operators were killed. And there were members of Congress that didn't even know we had 800 troops in Niger doing counter-ISIS operations. Mm. And so I was a little frustrated with that, you know. And I knew, like, I was listening to Dunford, you know, hey, you know, the force will tell me whether you're doing a good job. And I knew that I had to use my platform, and I had to be a voice for the entire joint force, and I had to deliver themes and messages that not only complemented what the chairman and the secretary of defense and the administration was doing with their national security strategy, national defense, and national military strategies, but an emotive, motivational message that wouldn't only echo that, but would pump the troops up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it
mission
was
mission accomplished.
Yeah, 2017, I went over to Syria, and I was with our most elite Army Special Operations Unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the U.S. Special Operations Command Senior Enlisted Leader with me, the Joint Special Operations Command Senior Enlisted Leader with me, and that unit CSM with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew into Syria, and then we got on a helicopter and we went to Raqqa, which was, you know, the caliphate
for epicenter.
Yeah, for Al-Qaeda. ISIS at the time. And it was in the middle of the fight to take Raqqa. And here are the Syrian Democratic Forces, which were the Kurdish forces that were our partner force that we were advising to get after the enemy, were fighting these ISIS targets in there. And I was up on the roof of this building. And the guy in charge of the whole fight there, I showed up, you know, he's wearing a slick uniform. He's got some stubble on his face and everything. And he doesn't tell me, he just tells me his first name and everything. And he's starting to tell me about what's going on with the fight. And he's dropping F-bombs left and right. And, you know, his language and his vernacular was like how I used to talk, you know. And and so finally I said, all right, dude, no bullshit, okay. What rank are you, okay? He said, I am a newly promoted sergeant major. So think of this. The number one main effort for the United States military at that time was the lasting defeat of ISIS, as stated by the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. And the guy in charge of the mission to get after the caliphate and in the lasting defeat, the guy in charge wasn't a general, wasn't a colonel. It was a sergeant major. His boss was at the cement factory, which is, you know, an hour away, mm-hmm. planning for future operations. Mm-hmm. His sergeant major was leading the fight on the ground. And I was so proud that day. I'm not anti-officer, Brian.
No, I get it, yeah.
But the discipline initiative and the focus and leadership of our enlisted is, again, our greatest competitive advantage. And to see it in action there, it made an impact. So we're watching this fight, and I had been talking with another one of these elite operators that was a sergeant major. He and I are very good friends today. And we kept talking about professional development and lethality. And we kept talking about the entrenching tool, you know, that not only do we have to have people that understand, you know, military customs and courtesies and can enforce standards and discipline, but they have to be so lethal that not only can they shoot better than their enemy, but if need be, they can beat them to death with a potential entrenching tool, you know, or whatever, a non-standard weapon. So anyways, we're up there, and here's a lull in the fight. And every time there was a lull in the fight, a vehicle-borne IED would come out, or a female suicide vest bomber would come out and do an attack on our, you know, our Syrian Democratic Forces. And so finally, I'm up on that roof watching this, and I looked, excuse me, and I said, you know what? This is bullshit. These assholes have two options. They can surrender or die, all right? And then the unit sergeant major says to me, well, what do you mean by that? I said, hey, look, we're the United States of America. We're a peace-loving nation, and if they surrender, we will treat them humanely. We'll safeguard them to their detainee holding facility center. We'll give them chow, a place to sleep, and we'll give them due process, all right? But let there be no doubt, if they don't surrender, then we're going to kill them with extreme prejudice, whether that is dropping bombs on them, shooting them in the face, or if need be, and I looked at my buddy and said, beating them to death with our entrenching tools. So he tells me, he says, you need to put that in your update to General Dunford and Secretary Mattis. I said, okay, I'll do that. So I did put that in the update, and when I got back to the Pentagon after that visit, Mattis comes and sees me, and he says, I want you to keep saying that. Because Mattis's narrative at that time was, we're not going to just defeat our enemies, we're going to annihilate them. And so I kept saying it wherever I went, and it was never an issue until it was Christmas of 5 years ago, and I was on a USO tour, and I had been saying it everywhere, and here I am in Bagram Airfield in the big hangar there, and, you know, troops everywhere. I got all these WWE superstars, movie stars, artists and everything. But it's Dunford, me, and Flo Groberg, Medal of Honor recipient, on the stage. Flo and I both are holding entrenching tools. And I went into my routine. And I said, let there be no doubt, you know, that we're on orders to kill the enemy. And I said, they have two options, surrender or die. And I went through it, and I held up that entrenching tool, or we will beat them to death with our entrenching tools. And the crowd went bananas.
Yeah.
But afterwards, here comes a little portly lad with crossed cameras, and he walks up to me, and he's a Washington Post reporter. And he says, hey, I can't believe you just, you know, told the troops to go out and commit war crimes. I said, I didn't tell them to do that. I said, we will use any means necessary in the law of war rules to kill the enemy. I said, and we teach soldiers, Marines, and non-standard, battlefield airmen how to use non-standard weapons to kill the enemy. And he said, well, I'm going to go public with this on a story. And so I called up my public affairs guy, Rob Couture, Master Sergeant retired, public affairs guy extraordinaire, who was home at Fort Meade opening presents. It was Christmas Day with his kids. And I said, what should we do? He said, send me a picture of you holding an entrenching tool, talking to the troops. And he said, I'll take care of it. And what he did is he put the quote that I made on all forms of social media with that picture. And it, we did this to just, you know, kill the story by the Washington Post.
Right.
And I had been saying this for months, and it was to inspire the troops, you know, to give that motivation to the troops.
Because you're aggressive, and you're not going to sit on your heels.
That's right.
Okay.
And this when he did that, it went viral.
Yep.
All over the world. I was getting notes and messages from troops around the world saying, thank you, thank you. But all of a sudden, you know, and then the Fox 5, you know, News, they did a special on it and everything. But I was getting criticized by CNN, ABC, New York Times, you know, all of these people that are leaning a little bit left and everything. But the worst thing, Brian, was when I got back, all of a sudden the landscape in the Pentagon started changing. And people were like, who is this guy, this enlisted guy, that thinks that he can say something like that, you know? And then I even had one, you know, peer of mine that was retired now come back to me and says, since when do you start addressing foreign policy? I said, look, dude, first of all, stay in your effing lane. Second of all, this isn't addressing foreign policy. I said, this is a motivational message to the troops, and it's a signal to the enemy that we ain't going to put up with this shit, that they're going to lose. And I said, and the last thing is, General Dunford and Secretary Mattis are approving of what I'm saying. I even had a three-star Navy guy, an admiral, come into my office, and he says to me, you do realize that enlisted are meant to be seen and not heard, right? And I was like, thinking to myself, we can all be some fighting MFers in here tonight, Admiral. But I told him, I said, Admiral, if you got a problem, see that office down the hallway that says Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or that one upstairs that says Secretary of Defense, go let them know that you don't like what I said. I said, but I stand by what I said, and I'm not going to change it. And I had another general tell me that I needed to walk it back and apologize. And I said, I'll be a hypocrite if I do that. I'm telling the troops what they should, what they want to hear and what they need to hear to get after the enemy. And I'm sending motivational messages, which is what my job is as the senior enlisted guy of the DOD. And you're telling me that I need to just apologize? I said, absolutely not. Well, then it was, you know, a few months later, and then bad things happened to me. I recovered from that. But in the end, I got back in, and my last year, I spent the year doing the same things I've done all the time, and I continued to do. And in December of 2019, I left the force. And since I've retired, you know, I continue to give back to the veteran community in any way I can. I am the national ambassador for the Veterans of Foreign War. I pay it forward to the current force by being a leadership and motivational speaker. And I'm here at the Maneuver Warfighting Conference supporting organizations like Beaver Fit, the ESS Eyewear, and Adaton Software, who are providing solutions for lethality, fitness, accountability, administration to assist the current force. And then the last thing, I'm looking for ways to, you know, spend time with my family now, Brian. And my wife and I just got back from a five-day vacation in Hawaii where we celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary, and we renewed our vows on Wailea Beach while we were there.
That's awesome. Did you wear a Hawaiian shirt?
I did wear a Hawaiian shirt. Nice. I had a lei on. Nice. You know, I even got our love beads that were given to us by the preacher over there that helped us renew our vows.
Yeah.
And I had a great friend of mine, a retired Marine Sergeant Major, Tony Spud Spadaro, well-known in Army circles. He retired as the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command Senior Enlisted Leader. He was a great teammate of mine. We did a lot of critical trips to places like Taiwan, to the Korean Peninsula, to Japan, to Indonesia, Singapore, places like that, as we were building this integrated deterrence. So he and his wife stood up with us. He was my best man in my vow renewal. But that's kind of what I'm doing now, and that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
Here, and it's been an honor to be here with you.
Oh, man, I appreciate you taking the time and trusting me to capture that story.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, there's a lot of things in there that I don't think I've ever read anywhere.
Yeah.
And which I haven't read your book yet.
Well, we're gonna fix that here right quick.
Nice,
right?
Yeah. So I kind of end things with a few ignorant civilian questions.
Yeah,
right? We kind of do like a Mad Minute type deal, because we are running close to 2 hours.
Yeah.
Right. So these, just answer these as best you can. It's just getting to know, you know, John Wayne Troxell just a little bit.
Yep.
All right. Coke or Pepsi?
Diet Pepsi.
Diet Pepsi. Okay. How do you get your eggs?
Scrambled.
Okay. What was your first car?
79 Cherry Red Buick Skylark.
Nice. What color is the interior?
It was burgundy.
Burgundy. Yeah. Yep. Sounds about right for a Buick Skylark. If you're going to recommend a book other than your own. Sorry. You wouldn't say that. I just threw that out there. If you were going to recommend a book for a young NCO, a young enlisted soldier, male, female, whatever, to read, what would you
do? Well, there? So there's two books that I would recommend. The first one is Rifleman Dodd, which is kind of an institutional book in the Marine Corps, but it is a, you know, short read, but it shows the necessity for physical, mental, and emotional readiness and tactical and technical excellence out of service members. And it talks about a troop, Rifleman Dodd, who was in the UK military during the Boer Wars, and he got separated from his unit. Didn't have food. He had to forage for food and everything. But every day, he would make sure his rifle was newly oiled. Mm. His ammunition in the magazines were, you know, ready to go. He made sure that he was ready to go, even though he didn't have food, he didn't have water and everything like that. And it's about overcoming adversity, even with safety and survival necessities, to still be that lethal warrior. That's one I would recommend to anybody and everybody, especially young troops. But everybody in the military faces adversity of some kind. And you have to be a stoic sometimes in the face of adversity. And I know this firsthand at the strategic level. And the book that helped me was a book called Philosophical Thoughts of a Fighter Pilot by Medal of Honor recipient Admiral James Stockdale. And he talks about his 7 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam and how being a stoic and allowed him to endure, survive, but more importantly, thrive under those conditions of torture, starvation, sleep deprivation, and all these other things. Those are the two books that I would recommend. And then obviously Surrender or Die, Reflections of a Combat Leader by SEAC retired John Wayne Troxell. Sorry.
Yeah, no. Hey, it's all good. You can get that at Amazon.
Amazon.
Your website.
Yep. Or my website, pmehard.com.
Yeah. I read the Daily Stoic.
Yeah.
So I have that on my desk, and that's part of my, like, I read John Maxwell's Daily Devotion, and then I do the Daily Stoic. And it's funny.
So you know who Epictetus is then, you know, guy that wrote the Echidarian, and, you know, the guy that was a slave in the Roman days and how he endured as being a slave. And when he came out, he was the guy that kind of built and developed Stoicism.
Yeah. And then Marcus Aurelius, everything being around journaling.
Yeah.
And I've even, like, because, my faith with Christianity and things, like, I've presented it to some preachers, like, hey, what if we look at David's Psalms like this?
Yeah.
Like, David was journaling these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, using that Marcus Aurelius approach, and it's just, like, it's eye-opening. So Stoicism, definitely jump in.
Yeah.
You guys check those things out. What's your truck or car radio on right now back home?
It's on my Sirius satellite radio, and it's probably on the Blend station or Channel 17 is where a lot of the oldies, you know, the more I get older, you know, and I'll be 60 years old here pretty soon, the more nostalgic I get. So I'm doing a lot of listening to, older 70s and 80s rock music and stuff like that.
You can't call that old. When I think oldies, I'm thinking like 50s, like Buddy Holly. Like,
well, yeah, I listen to that
70s
too.
And 80s is not, I mean, Def Leppard is not old.
But I'm a big karaoke guy, too, and my karaoke group that I sing is Blink-182.
No way.
And I can hit all the small things. I can hit What's My Age Again, you know. I mean, I'm pretty good at that. Right. I can also do Basket Case, you know, by Green Day. Yeah.
All right, next time we're together, we're going karaokeing, because mine is Regulators by Warren G.
Oh, yeah.
And Nate Dogg. I do both parts by myself.
And I will tell you, my karaoke partner when I was in Korea, a great infantryman, a great ranger, Ray Devins, he and I as a team would hit Basket Case. And I will tell you, Green Day would have been proud hearing us say that after about 10 or 12 shots of Soju.
That's awesome. Well, I don't think there's a need for any other questions. I think that's a great point to drop it off.
Well, I just want to let your audience know that I brought a copy of my book today. And, Brian, you know, I really appreciate what you are doing. And Josh Powers, my good buddy that, you know, I was able to serve with at First Corps and everything. So I just want to take this time to leave you with a signed copy of my book as a way of saying thank you for what you're doing. But more importantly, using the Infantry Podcast to continue to educate folks out there and give folks something that they can listen to that will give them insight at what's going on in the infantry world. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. All right. All right. Thanks for being here.
Ooh.
Hi, this is Rob Choppa, retired infantryman, 54th Chief of Infantry, and currently the president of the National Infantry Association. Thank you for listening to the Infantry Podcast. I want you to become a member of the National Infantry Association. It's your professional organization. Join our team at www.infantryassn.org. Thank you. Follow me. And that's an order.